From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
This legislation ends the least equitable system of school funding in the country. We indicted the system, but we didn't just indict it. We put something in place that would correct all of the ills that surround it.
I stand for the taxpayers today and say we cannot afford $7.5 billion. We cannot afford more property taxes. I urge a no vote.
It's interesting that the one way to fund public schools appropriately today hinges on whether we will provide a tax credit shelter for people who have the money to fund parochial education.
This is what compromise looks like. This is it. A bill that none of us like at 100%.
Today, we are making Illinois history. Today, we ensure that in the future, every child in Illinois has an equal chance at an excellent education.
Governor Bruce Rauner and others talking about the new school funding legislation. The state of Illinois has long held the title of the most inequitable funding system in the country. Heavily reliant on property taxes, the wealthier areas have more resources for their schools. And now Illinois lawmakers and the governor have done something about that. We're going to talk more about the change, that and more, coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Joining me in studio, Charlie Wheeler. Charlie is director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And in our Statehouse studio, we have Brian Mackey, IPR Statehouse reporter, and Dusty Rhodes. She's the Education Desk reporter for NPR Illinois, and she's been covering this issue for many months now. And Dusty, schools are going to get their money from the state. That's the short-term part of this that now allows the money from the budget to flow to schools. But the new funding formula will change how money is distributed going forward. That's a pretty big deal.
That's a really huge deal. It's actually taking time for it to actually sink in what a huge deal it is. But the formula we've been using since 1997 has this magical number, $6,119, as the cost of educating a kid. And, you know, that number has nothing to do with any kind of reality. It was set at a time when they said, here's how much money we have. How do we divvy it up? It was like, you know, it wasn't based on how much does it actually cost to educate a child. And so we're replacing it with a formula that is based on how much does it cost to educate all different kinds of kids. Like, it costs more to educate a kid if they're low income. It costs more if they're don't speak English. It costs more if a kid is both of those things. You know, this new formula takes all of that into account.
And just to put that, you know, to hammer the point that Dusty was making, you know, that formula change went through in 1997. And even then, there were a lot of people who wanted a different way of funding education in Illinois at that time. And since then, there have been all these other attempts. Longtime listeners of the program and education advocates will remember the HB 750 debate from about 10 years ago.
James Meeks.
Yeah, the property tax swap. So, I mean, there have been efforts to change the way Illinois funds education, lawsuits that have gone up to the Illinois Supreme Court a couple of times over the decades, for quite a long time. So it would be difficult to overstate the significance of the passage of this law.
And Charlie, why has it been so hard to get this done? It seems like everybody thinks it's a good idea. Why has it been so hard?
Well, it's a matter of having the money to do it, and then how do you allocate the money? One of the problems in the past, you alluded to 750 and some of the other efforts, the pot wasn't getting big enough so that everybody got the same amount and we could still do enough to help the districts that, because of their tax base, were really hurting. The wealthy districts didn't want to give up any of their state aid. They get such a small amount anyway. I think the most wealthy school districts, something like 2% of their budget comes from the state, and something like 90-some percent comes from the local property taxes. And so that was one of the issues. And the number that Dusty referred to, the 6,119, that was put in place based on a lot of number crunching and data analysis that showed, well, schools that seem to operate efficiently and seem to have good results on tests, this is kind of what they spend. And so it was not, what would you say, it was not really scientifically built up by looking at what are the elements that go, that research has shown help provide a quality education, help kids learn. The new formula incorporates these elements, and instead of having a foundation level that the state guarantees in theory, and I say that because we've been prorating it in some of the recent years, instead of saying there's a flat number that covers everybody, now every school district will have its own, the equivalent of a foundation level, its adequacy level. For this school district with this mix of kids, these kids with special needs, these kids who don't speak English, these kids who come from lower income families, this is what this school district needs to be able to adequately educate those children.
Charlie mentioned the fact that for years it was tough to come up with the money that was needed. Dusty, the state's certainly not in any better shape, maybe even worse shape as it's ever been financially. Are things going to get noticeably better anytime soon, or is it going to take years and years of additional money being put into this system?
I remember being in a commission meeting where models were handed out of the concept of what has become this law. And I remember Senator Andy Menar, who's really done the majority of the work on this over the past 4.5 years, he looked at it and said, you know, if you look at this, a kid who enters kindergarten is not going to have an equitable funding system by the time they graduate from high school. And there were kind of nods around the table like, well, yeah, but so it's going to take a while. But it's such a huge thing to just turn to a different path. So it will all depend on how much new dollars we put into education. But I think that once people see that it is helping, maybe they'll be more inclined to, you know, pony up that dough.
Well, I know there are a lot of people out there, too, who are saying, hey, I spend a lot on property taxes, and my taxes primarily go to the school district. Does this help that situation at all?
Yes, it does. It's got some triggers in there that can, because that was another huge topic of the commission. There were a lot of people sitting around that table who, you know, that was their constituents' main concern. And so there's some transparency built in where now that you see exactly what the adequacy target is for your school district and you're way above it, that makes it easier to go to voters and say, would you like to lower your property taxes? So school districts that are at 110% of adequacy or above have a right to have that referendum now. And so that will be up to voters. And some of those Collier County suburbs can decide whether or not they want to keep competing with each other. And, you know, oh, well, we've got photography and we've got multimedia and we've got, you know, like how many
sushi bars in the lunchroom is one of my favorite examples.
Sushi bar, the fair trade coffee thing, you know, just how fancy do we want to go? So, you know, that will be up to them now.
And yeah, but on the other side of it, though, I think we've heard some of the opponents of this say that in Chicago, this does authorize further property tax increases. And residents in Chicago have seen a lot of taxes go up lately between the pop tax and sugary sweetened beverage tax, as well as property tax increases there as the city is trying to dig out both the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund and the municipal employees pension shortfalls, I should say, the city is trying to dig out from underfunding those pension systems for many years.
Well, I'm not an expert on Chicago, but one thing that I didn't know until I sat through all the commission meetings was that Chicago has, you know, two different levels of taxes that they, you know, like they rely more on commercial property than residential property, and residential gets a break because of that. So this kind of might bring them back up a little bit more to closer to reality.
And of course, we heard the governor going around the state, Charlie, saying that this was the original legislation was a bailout for Chicago, and in the end, actually more money than what was originally thought is going to wind up going into the Chicago public school system, especially I think to help with their pension system. Are you surprised by that this worked out this way?
No, I'm not surprised that this was the ultimate resolution of it, but I thought what would have to happen would be the governor's veto of the original school funding bill would have to be overridden. But to his credit, he kind of backed away from his demagoguery about bailing out Chicago and signed the bill. And I say demagoguery because I can't remember another governor with such a divisive game plan trying to pit geographic areas of the state against one another, and often not being factually accurate. I recall he went to a downstate school district and complained, your money shouldn't go to Chicago, blah, blah, blah. And I looked up the data from the State Board of Education. Turns out that this particular school district got a larger percentage share of its costs paid by the state than the city of Chicago did. And as a matter of fact, the school districts with the highest property tax rates tend to be in the south suburbs, where there's very little manufacturing anymore, very little industry, not much of a commercial base, so it all falls on homeowners.
And I grew up downstate, and I went to a school district that for years was on the financial watch list over and over, had to make a lot of cuts even when I was in high school, cut a lot of foreign language, things like that. Those were the schools that were really, I believe, spotlighted for the need for the changes. The downstate schools, especially a lot of them in rural areas, but maybe in suburban areas as well. But a lot of these other schools, or a lot of these other areas of the state where, let's say, private schools are very popular, there's something in this for people there as well. And Dusty, can you talk about that?
The private school scholarship tuition tax credit thing. Mm-hmm. That got put in after the four leaders began negotiating to arrive at a compromise because, let's not fail to realize that the governor's amendatory veto made a long list of sweeping changes, none of which appear in the compromise bill. So the compromise bill is Senate Bill 1, Andy Menard's bill, with this private school thing layered on top of it. So the Democrats built a box around it so that it's limited. It sunsets in 5 years. It won't be renewed unless it proves itself. They narrowed the scope of it to make it really focused on lower income kids in districts that are falling behind. So they tried to make the advocates of that plan true to what they said they wanted. When you say you're doing this to help poor kids get a better education, let's really make this help poor kids get a better education.
And this is not just this is not funding necessarily for these private schools. This is kind of going a backdoor way to do it, right? It's a tax credit for people.
Well, it, in theory, it gives you a tax credit if you make a donation to this foundation, which then will give out scholarships. And in its initial form, you would get 100% tax credit, and you'd also get to deduct it from your federal income tax. So if you put a lot of money into the private school foundation, you'd actually make money by saving on your federal taxes. But I'm pretty sure there's now a provision, isn't there, Dusty, that says you can't deduct from your federal income tax and then get the credit. And isn't the credit limited to 75% of what you contribute?
Yes. Yeah, they kind of tapered it down. So I think there's already 17 states that have some similar program. And so this is, Betsy DeVos, this is kind of part of her trend. But the fact that our four legislative leaders all graduated from Catholic school, this kind of it seems somewhat inevitable. If you look at the list of proponents of this piece of the bill, it included what you would expect, parochial schools, Jewish schools, Catholic schools, but it also included almost every blue-collar union you can think of, police officers, firefighters, pipe fitters. They're all the ones who wanted this. It just seems like it was a done deal.
Yeah, and I would, for full disclosure purposes, I'm also the product of a Dominican sister's education. This is something that has been percolating at a lower level for a long time. I think our colleague from Chicago public radio station WBEZ, Tony Arnold, had done a story about this, 2 years ago? It was something the governor had mentioned initially, but it did kind of spring out of nowhere, or seemingly kind of cropped up in the last few weeks of negotiations here, or last couple months anyway. And I mean, kind of bringing this full circle to the point of what, you know, why did the governor seem to change his mind on, going around the state, calling it a bailout for Chicago, and then basically the same bill passes? Well, the difference is this program that has a tax credit and also, you know, creates this scholarship fund. Some Democrats are calling it, a sort of backdoor or stealth voucher program for state government. The Republicans have and supporters of it have rejected that term. But that seems to be the difference that made the governor change his mind. Although he is not saying that, he pretty much is not really answering directly when he's been asked questions about, you know, why are you said it's terrible to give, you know, this bailout for Chicago. We should send that money to all these other schools. And now he's accepted a piece of legislation that actually sends more money to Chicago. Why? He's not saying.
Did he have a choice? Yeah. Did he have a choice, really? I mean,
what's that line about, you know, the leader wants to see where the parade's going so he can rush up and stand at the front of it and lead them?
When you think about it, the private school idea had been percolating in years past, but it had never been successful. And so it kind of found an opportunity to piggyback upon this legislation, which had to come through the budget. You know, like the first thing John Cullerton said when he spoke to the press after this bill was approved was, now we have a full budget. Now we finally have, after 2 years, a full budget. I mean, it kind of, these things all had to layer on top of each other to work.
Yeah, and I would just add, and I know Charlie was trying to get in there, but I mean, this is what politics is supposed to be. This is what we have failed to have 2 years. It's horse trading. It's, you know, you see an opportunity to get something you want, and you come to a compromise. You don't stand back and say, well, we Democrats are not going to raise taxes on our own unless the Republicans come along, and the governor's going to, you know, I'm not going to go along with anything unless I get my full agenda or these agenda items I want. No, you actually compromise. You come up with something that, as we heard Senator Kimberly Lightfoot at the top of the show saying, it's something that none of us really like 100%, but this is what compromise looks like. This is what politics and the legislative process is supposed to be like.
Yeah, exactly. And what I was going to say, and again, full disclosure, I'm a product of private education. The first involvement I ever had with public education was when I was hired here at the university. But I don't like that tax credit program. As a matter of fact, I think a voucher program where the money helped out the parents of these kids who pay parochial school tuition, I would be less, what would you say, upset about a program like that rather than one that gives wealthy individuals a way to reduce the money that is actually coming into the state. But on the other hand, as Brian said, and as I said about the governor when he vetoed the original bill because it only had 90% of what he wanted, politics, as was said, is the art of compromise. You don't get 100% all the time. You have to appreciate that you get most of what you want if you're lucky, but you also have to give the other guy an opportunity to say, oh, I got this. Kind of a face-saving thing. And I think the governor, as I said earlier, had no choice. He was going to be overridden on Senate Bill 1, his veto, that amendatory veto, which brought in a lot of horrible stuff. He would have been overridden. So he was faced with, okay, the leaders have negotiated this plan. You better be on board or you're going to lose big time.
And Dusty, basically, he took a victory.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that what he, you know, what he did was get out of the way. I think he saw that. Let's remember when his amendatory veto, the Democrats put it into a bill and ran it for a vote. Obviously, ceremonial. It got zero yes. Nobody pushed their green button for that bill. I know that that was pre-planned. Would it have been different if they hadn't said, don't vote for this? I mean, it did so much, it had so much potential damage in it. It was kind of a trick. It was like, you get more money right now, but 3 years from now, the bottom's going to fall out. And I think people saw past that. They saw through that. This is kind of amazing to me that we passed this compromise without spreadsheets. There's no, here's how much this district gets and here's how much that district gets, which has been the thing that has to happen with every education funding bill. The compromise contains things that can't be modeled out, you know, out into the future, as did the amendatory veto. And, you know, this was passed on concepts, principles, oddly enough.
And the it's a vote of confidence in the legislature for the old smoke-filled room again, although nobody smokes anymore, at least not in the Capitol building. They're not supposed to.
They were in an amber ballroom.
As we heard Lita Brady say. Yeah, but no, it's, I mean, this is the four legislative leaders got together. They hammered out a compromise. You know, for over the years, we've heard a lot of people criticize when things come out, with not a lot of public vetting. And I will say, it was not great that there wasn't a lot of public transparency here. No, a lot of people did not. We didn't even get to see the language of this bill until what?
Noon on Monday.
Yeah, before the legislators were coming to vote for it that day. But as you know, Dusty said, this had been a lot of these concepts, at least, had been discussed and debated in task forces and legislative hearings for a long time. But this is how things are supposed to work around here. I'll leave it at that.
And what we've learned is I'm the only product of a poor downstate district, which I think people could figure that out by listening to the
show
here.
Hello. I'm a product of really poor public schools in East Texas.
Well, there it is. We're on a par, I guess. But I do want to save some time this week to talk about some legislation the governor acted on this week. He did sign something called the Trust Act. Brian, can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, this is a piece of legislation that had been pushed by Democrats in Illinois, starting with Democrats, but they did negotiate it with law enforcement, and the governor, during his signing ceremony, made sure to have a lot of police officers in uniform. He were sort of pushed into the frame so that they were in camera view, standing behind him as he signed it. This is a piece of legislation that says that Illinois law enforcement is not supposed to be sort of a wing of federal immigration enforcement. The idea of calling it the Trust Act is that as the President Trump's administration has stepped up enforcement of immigration laws, people are afraid to go to the police. If you're a victim of a crime, maybe you don't want to go to the police because you're worried that they may begin looking skeptically at you or your family members and turn you over for deportation potentially. So the idea here is that state and local police cannot do arrests for immigration law violations. There are limits to how much they can, they have to have specific federal warrants if they're going to hold somebody solely for an immigration reason. They can't just, if you've been arrested for a misdemeanor or something and you're going to get bail, they can't hold you longer for federal immigration. What is interesting here is that the governor went on Fox News a couple of weeks ago. He was asked about this. And, this is a big issue for conservatives. And he did not win a lot of conservative applause from his performance in that interview. And you even heard this week people saying, why is the governor doing this? He's betraying some members of the conservative Republican coalition who don't like to see this. People are throwing around the word sanctuary state. Backers of this bill reject that. But this is something that could create trouble for the governor with some people who really believe strongly stricter enforcement of immigration policies in America.
The governor also angered some people by vetoing a piece of legislation, the minimum wage hike. And Charlie, this was something that over the next 5 years or so would have raised the wage all the way up to $15 an hour. The governor siding more with, I guess, the business groups, especially, who did not want to see this happen.
Yeah, business groups have been pretty much universally opposed to the notion of raising the minimum wage. Their argument is, we will pay the market rates, but if you cause us to have to pay an artificially high wage level, we're going to have to make cuts somewhere else. We're either going to hire fewer people, we're going to reduce the hours of the people we have on board now, and in some cases we may actually have to close our doors. And the flip side of the coin, the advocates say, well, if people made more money, they'd be buying more of the stuff you're selling, and so you wouldn't have to worry about covering the additional wages because you'd be bringing in more money. But his veto was not really surprising, and it's not surprising the sponsors of the bill are going to try and override it. And I guess they could point to the referendum of a couple years ago where voters overwhelmingly approved the notion of raising the minimum wage. But it was only an advisory referendum, and it's taken this long for the General Assembly to finally pass something.
It's a lot lower amount that time.
Well, it was like up to from $8.25 to $10 immediately. The referendum was in November. The increase would have been January 1st.
Time now for our notes from the field. And Dusty, let's start with you.
Oh, well, there was yet another cartoon. I guess everybody remembers the cartoon controversy about the, you know, what a lot of people call a racist cartoon by the Illinois Policy Institute's cartoonist, depicting Chicago public schools as a poor black kid begging for money from rich white businessmen. So there, he did another one this week. Gosh, this has been a long week. We're the same little kid catches Rahm Emanuel wearing a tutu and stealing cookies out of the TIFF cookie jar. But this one didn't attract nearly as much attention. It's just, I think, you know, we all need a vacation after this school funding.
Well, Brian, let's move on to you.
Yeah, word is that the Sangamon County Republican Party Central Committee reporting from Bernie Schoenberg in the SJR, has voted unanimously to back Steve McClure, who is an assistant state's attorney here in Sangamon County, against Sam McCann, whose name will be familiar to listeners. He is a state senator who has defied Governor Rauner. The governor tried unsuccessfully to defeat him in his last re-election attempt a couple of years ago. Senator McCann stuck around, and he has continued to vote against the governor on some issues. And so, once again, the Republican Party is looking to expel one of their own, who has shown himself to be willing to diverge from what his colleagues are doing on certain bills.
And Charlie?
Well, one of the other bills that was signed in the recent days was an automatic voter registration measure, which would say when you go to the Secretary of State's office to renew your driver's license, you will automatically be registered to vote unless you say no. And it would also apply when you interact with other state agencies, too. And the idea is to try and make it as easy as possible for people to be registered, to update their addresses when they move, so that we encourage more people to go to the polls. And so I personally think it's a very good idea.
That does it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Dusty Rhodes. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. The production assistance for State Week provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.